It's the 7th chapter of 1 Corinthians, verse 1, concerning the things of which you wrote. It is good for a man not to touch a woman. Now I'm going to stop right there and take care of that first. You know, these are toughies, and that's good. I like that. Obviously, he does not mean literally not to touch a woman, else there'd be no shaking of hands or greetings or anything of that type. So we right at the outset eliminate the option that there should never be any bodily contact whatsoever. On the other side of the coin, I would say, again, you've got to understand the Greek society of those days. There was a great deal of what we would call promiscuity. The whole situation was so free and licentious that Paul is making a thrust here that is a general statement that there must be some propriety in our dealings with these matters. Now, I have seen and observed in some men in the ministry an unwholesome tendency to too much putting the arm around women in the group and so forth, and there's been too much closeness. I've seen it. It's a very risky thing. On the other hand, never to touch would be robbing of some note of comfort. Frequently, when I pray with someone, when I'm praying with a woman, I'll take her hand and pray with her because there's a communication of the Spirit of Christ in that. I feel no qualm about doing such a thing. But I have to be very, very careful, as any man should be, to just be appropriate. But putting that over against what Paul is talking about, that is that friendly touch that is not uncommon and not inappropriate, is a far cry from the thing that Paul is driving at here, which was in the Greek society a total freedom, much like we have today in some of the group activities of sensitivity training and the touch theory and so forth, where they do more than just touching. It is a total ignoring of the proprieties of this relationship. I think we can strike an easy attitude here where we say that a genuine expression of touch in the name of Christ in a token of sympathy is hardly ruled out by this passage. But carelessness in terms of that sort of thing can lead to trouble. I think that's where we have to rest the case. And I'm comfortable with that. I think it's sound. So I had to take care of that immediately because it is such a strong statement. And I think it's in the spirit of the kind of statement we might make about a certain situation. Well, for example, I took a case just this last week where the man that referred the person to me said, I wouldn't touch this with a 10-foot pole. Now, of course, that's almost the same spirit as this. It isn't an absolute. He doesn't mean he's never going to speak to this person again or would never assist in the counseling. He just meant that the case was over his head. Now this is what Paul is saying, or like a mother may say to her child, now don't you dare touch that, see. Of course, the moment you say that to the child, the next action is to touch it. Of course, you know that. Well, she wouldn't probably destroy the child if it touched something, but she means I don't want you to play with that, or I don't want you to handle it, or I don't want you to break it. So you say, just don't touch. All right, I think that should cover that. Now, we'll move on then. Now he says, on account of porneia, fornication, let each have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. Now we're getting to the issue that today is rather common in our society of the wife swapping. Like I said, this is a tough passage, but we're just going to plow into it anyway and talk about it. There's no place whatsoever in any way, shape, or form for that kind of activity within the Christian circles. though it was a common thing in the Greek society, as it is also common today. That's why I have to put it in there. But one thing that intrigues me about these words, Paul is talking to Christian people. And I have long had to say to you that salvation is based upon our acceptance of Christ. The problems of controlling our lives are part of God's work within us. Don't misunderstand me. I don't mean he's indifferent to it. But the person who accepts Christ, one of the prevailing attitudes of that person is, I want to do what God would please God. You see. They may not always make it. There is room here for the human element, but the desire is to please God. This does not give license, nor, as I've said to you before, do I find people really looking for license. I do not find Christians, generally speaking, who are saying to me, I want to go as far as I can and still get by. You know, the attitude generally is very much sensitive, maybe not always controlled. People have more or less degree of control. And incidentally, on that subject, from a psychological point of view, I have to point out the following. I talked to some people, in fact, a young person just a few days ago, whose way of life, whose natural controls would be the envy of many Christians. I'm thinking of a young person that, as I examined their lifestyle and actions and attitudes, I had to say, well, probably if you became a Christian, you wouldn't change much. This person was a young man, not particularly interested in dating, although, you know, not on a problem basis. He wasn't out of touch with the opposite sex, but he liked to read. He's a quiet type of individual. He had his hobbies and interests, and he just wasn't bugged by that. He didn't drink, didn't smoke, no pot, none of those things. Just a nice all-around fellow, and his family was the same. Six or so in the family, all of them about in the same kind of mold. So it's a nice thing if you can be born with that kind of generalization, because that had nothing to do with any spiritual qualities that he had. He wasn't really particularly with Christ. He went to church, but I wouldn't say that he really had any grip on Christ. The average person doesn't. Well, as I have seen both in training and in practice and experience, you have very large degrees of difference between makeup, psychologically, physiologically, that accounts for behavior problems. So you have in the same family one young person who is almost uncontrollable, and yet a brother or a sister that lives a very normal life, you see, and that one is no higher in God's sight than the other. We'll put it this way. God allows each of us to wrestle with the particular personality problems that we have. And it is not so much how victorious we are in becoming an ascetic. It is how we cope with the problems that we are confronted with by virtue of our normal daily life. Thus, a person who has inherited a tendency that is neurotic, at least, because some of these things are neurotic tendencies where you have hyperactivity, you have a hyperactive thyroid, for example. A child with a hyperactive thyroid is going to be in trouble all the time at school. Usually, going to be very active. They're not going to be able to keep enough for them to keep busy. So here is a physiological problem. The kid had nothing to do with it. But he's hyperactive and he's always in trouble. But people that have problem children are probably just as good parents. I mean to say, the fact that they have problem children gives them a different kind of a situation, so that they cannot be compared with people whose children tend to be a little less hyperactive. And the Lord understands all these degrees of difference. And it really then boils down to how a parent copes with the problem rather than how successful they are with that young person. Thus, if a parent gives attention to spiritual training, if they set a good example before the young person, if they keep them in fellowship with the right people, with the Lord's people, and do everything they can, the Lord gives them just as much of a rating as the person who has children that tend to be normally fairly well behaved, you see. The Lord knows our hearts. That's the big thing. That's what David taught us. And even though David had his struggles, see, David was the kind of person that had a dynamic drive, and he would be more likely to get into mischief than the person that didn't have that kind of a drive, you see. That's the problem. The problem in leadership is because you're constantly forced to make decisions, your batting average may be different than the person who doesn't have to make decisions all the time, you see. The more you do, the more likely you are to make mistakes. The only way not to make mistakes is not to do anything. So you plunge in, just like with myself here. I plunge into some of these passages. I'm not reluctant to speak about them. And I just trust the Spirit to give us the truth here in the matter. But we're open, we're more vulnerable to criticism if we tackle these difficult things, like the sessions we've had with you late. One would be very vulnerable talking about those situations. So what I'm saying is that the whole issue of our success in life turns not around the lack of mistakes, but around the heart and the motive of our lives. All right, now, moving on in this passage, of course, let me go back and restate the thesis that Paul is writing here to Christian people, and evidently they were having problems with some of these things. And yet they were still classified as saints. And that, I say to you, does not give people license to do what they will, but only shows the mercy of God to help us battle the problems that we meet in our society. And of course, city people, people who are raised in metropolitan areas like Los Angeles, have a more difficult time in some areas than people that are raised in a different situation. More exposure, and especially today as compared to earlier days where we're a mobile society, there is always some place to go. The competition is fierce as far as meetings like this are concerned, because there are always so many things that you can do in Southern California rather than go to a meeting. Whereas if you're in some farm community in the Middle West, there's nothing to do anyway. If somebody has a meeting, well, you go to the meeting because you haven't got anything else to do. All right, now he goes on in some very practical suggestions regarding husbands and wives. But let me say to you that several times in this chapter, and never or at least maybe once more in the scripture, does Paul use this expression where he says, I say this by permission and not by commandments. In other words, several times in this chapter, Paul makes it clear that he's saying what he thinks will be helpful to the group, but he's not giving them a thus saith the Lord about these things. Now, that does not have to do with the first things we read about. These matters, he does not say that he is giving an opinion. But when it comes to some of these matters of marriage, he's giving an opinion, which he thinks is a sound opinion, but he cannot say that it is absolutely a command of God. That helps to understand the passage. Now he says, let the husband render to his wife that which is due her, and likewise also the wife to the husband. For the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband. Likewise also the husband does not have authority over his body, but the wife. Do not withhold from one another, except it be by common agreement for a time, that you may devote yourselves to prayer, and then come together again, lest Satan should tempt you, for your incontinence. Now that really says almost the opposite of what you think it says. When a person reads that chapter, the husband reads the chapter and it says the wife does not have authority over her body but the husband, right away he thinks, oh yes, I can have privilege whenever I want it. It's I can, you know, tell her this whenever it's convenient for me. That's not quite what it means. What it is really saying is that the one is really helpless to receive the love they need unless it is offered by the other person. You don't have the authority to satisfy your needs unless they offer that satisfaction to you. You cannot. It really means you cannot go out and just take it. Especially husbands have a problem with this thing. I mean, it causes a lot of difficulty in marriage because the husband thinks that he now, because he's married, he has full right anytime he wants. He said. And that's a great difficulty. It's not true, and it's not what this passage says. It's really saying that only someone else can really satisfy us, and we cannot take it whenever we want it. We don't have the right to just take it. So the other person, the wife, for example, has authority over whether her husband is properly cared for or not. The husband has authority over whether the wife is properly cared for or not. If he abuses her, she's not taken care of. She's helpless in the matter. It's like in other areas of marriage, I've often had to remind young women, for example, that if they marry this person, they are in a certain way destined to share whatever lifestyle or responsibilities that person provides. Thus, a girl who marries a man that is rather ne'er-do-well, you know, and lethargic about things and doesn't provide properly for her, she's sort of destined then or doomed to suffer that fate. For example, if he doesn't provide proper medical help for her, he doesn't provide a proper place to live. Once she marries him, she's sort of helpless to really do a whole lot about it without, you know, divorcing him and going out on her own. So she's got to share whatever he provides for. If he provides well, she's lucky. If he doesn't provide well, she's in trouble. That's sad because a lot of women are married to children, to little boys that don't know how to take responsibility. And the wife suffers physical satisfaction much. Then they're being honest. But if they give them the impression that there's going to be satisfaction and there isn't, they're swindling them, you see. It's a cheat. And many, a couple, have had to live out years and years of distress because of this dishonesty. Well, Paul is trying to come to that. He says, look, you've got a certain kind of responsibility here. Now, on the other hand, you see, the other side of the coin is that I've said to you before that if you want a wholesome relationship, you've got to earn it in the sense that if you act ugly, the other person is not going to want to share with you their affections. If you want them to share affection with you, behave yourself, you know, act in ways that will entice them and will attract them, you see. Because that's what you do before you're married. You act in ways that you think will attract the other person. But then after the one gets married, there seems to be the sense that they don't have to do that anymore because the obligation is there. Now, I should like to think that everybody would be responsible in their married relationship to be sure the other person is taken care of, but I can't guarantee it. And if the best way to ensure that there's going to be satisfaction is to so act that you attract the other person to like you. And I've said to you before, and I just repeat it here for the moment, that remember that love in the Bible is a matter of caring and respect, and that affection is something you have to earn. If you want the other person to like you well enough to enjoy the romantic relationship, you've got to act in such ways that you attract them. Because you just can't go around, a girl can't go around acting like a witch all the time and expect the husband then to just feel so attracted to her. And the husband can't run around acting like a baby or a bully or anything and then expect his wife to want to be with him, you see. You have to earn that by proper conduct, by controlling yourself. The thing is, we control ourselves when it's necessary. And then we seem to let down when we get home and we act terrible to our family, and we can act as sweet as pie to the neighbors or to the business people. So you have the telephone operator that takes all kind of abuse over the phone and acts very sweetly about it. I like the story that the fellow is trying to get a number, and the girl is saying, "We don't have that information," and he's frustrated, and finally he says, "Who's crazy, you or me?" And she says very sweetly, "We don't have that information." But if she gets home, then she goes home at night, and somebody makes some little statement to her, and she blows her cork. But that's the way life is, because we think we have the right at home to be our ornery, ugly selves, and we may feel we have that right, but we lose the battle, because then nobody likes us. Then everybody has to put up with us. Paul said that wherever I go in the blessing of the gospel of Christ. It's a wonderful thing if you're going to be a blessing wherever you go instead of a problem. Paul is giving some interesting concepts here that are may not be commands of the Lord as such, but they're very, very important to a wholesome life. So he says, don't withhold from each other, but if he said there may be a time when you would mutually consent to give yourselves to devotion, or to you've got some service to render and you decide that you don't want to interfere with that by personal needs. Verse 6, this I say according to opinion and not according to order. The will that all men may be as I myself. But each one has his own gift from God. Some have one and some have another. I say to the unmarried and to the widows, it would be good for them if they would remain as I am. Now, that gives us a very strong hint that Paul was either had never been married or was married and now separated from his wife, or she had divorced him, or he had died, perhaps. In order to be a member of the Sanhedrin, you have to be married. And there's the indication that Paul was a member at one time of the Sanhedrin. So it is quite likely he had a wife at one time, but perhaps she left him or died or something. But at any rate, at that point of writing and thereafter, Paul remained single. And he says here, I'm giving this as opinion and not as commandment, that it would be better if you would remain as I. Later on he will say, and I have to bring it in here, later on he will say that the reason is that we're in very difficult times. And he said, I want to spare you in the flesh the problems that you will have as a married person. Now, for example, today over in Russia, the person that is married has very difficult problems, especially the Christian. Very serious problems. And Paul is saying, I can spare you this, if you remain single. So it is not that he thinks being single is more spiritual, but he wants to spare them trouble in the flesh. Now, he goes on to say in verse 9, if one cannot contain, then let them marry. And of course he says just above that some have a gift for this and some don't. To be able to handle a single life, according to Paul here, is a gift from God. And Jesus made the same statement in the Gospel, as recorded in the Gospel, that some are given this place of being, as he says, eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake. In other words, there were some whose ministry required them to remain single, and God gave them the gift to remain single without having to fight the battle of getting married. If, on the other hand, one has the strong drive that makes it important for them to be married, Paul goes on to say it's a very good institution. Marriage is fine if that's what the Lord gives you. If he gives you the grace not to be married in the present situation, you probably, he says, would be better off. But it's a gift. Generally speaking, the Lord's will is that people be married. The celibate attitude is not biblical. It's religious, and it's historically supported in the clergy, but it's not a biblical attitude, because Paul says himself later on, I will that the younger women marry, bear children, and keep the home. Generally speaking, Paul felt that women ought to be married. Well, if a woman is going to get married, you've got to have a husband. So generally speaking, the husband would have to also fall generally into the category of married persons. Who was it that said marriage is a great institution for women, but he doesn't recommend it for men? That's a little off base there, but it seems generally necessary, or generally in God's order, that people should marry. And I have to say to you, as one who's been in the leadership in the church, that it would be very difficult for a man to function wisely in counseling if you were not married. I cannot see how celibate leaders can be, by celibate we mean unmarried, of course, by celibate leaders can be good counsel for married couples. I can't for the life of me see how that can be solved. Generally speaking, the God's order was marriage, and in the Old Testament, the priests were all married. It was just assumed the priest would be married. And they were God. That was God's order. In the New Testament, in the church of the present day, there are some religious groups that, in terms of human reason, decide that a priest has to be too spiritual to be married. And it's been a great problem within the church, I have to say, honestly. Because they do not do much in the way of counseling. I've had to pick up an awful lot of wreckage from religious groups that do not believe that the clergy ought to be married. And so the counseling is always so poor that the marriages go on the rocks. You see then the spirit in which Paul says it would be better for the present moment to remain single as he was, but he was not urging that upon everyone, but only allowing that there might be some who had the gift to remain unmarried, and it is indeed a gift. To those who are married, I exhort, and not I, but the Lord. Here he changes his tack, and he says, now it's not my opinion, this is what the Lord would like to say to you about it. He said, let not a wife separate from her husband. But if also she be separated, let her remain unmarried, or let her be reconciled to her husband. And let not the husband leave the wife. Now, has to be seen in the moderation of the rest of the scripture. Jesus gives a definite indication in the Old Testament, in the Gospels, which are an extension of the Old Testament. Jesus gives the opinion, or gives the thought, that under certain conditions where there has been infidelity, unfaithfulness, the marriage contract is already broken and not valid, and therefore remarriage under those conditions seems to be something that Jesus allowed. Now, I'm plunging into a controversial area, so I'll just keep plunging. I've never taken a cop-out position that I could just blanketly refuse to consider any matter of divorce. I think that's a cop-out. I think it doesn't allow for many, many kinds of exceptions. I have gone in the first place on the basis that the Lord is at least as gracious to us in the New Testament as they were in the Old. In the Old Testament, it was quite in order that if there was a problem in a marriage, that there was the right of divorce and remarriage. Now Jesus, here you must understand the spirit in which he speaks in the Gospels. It's the same spirit in which he says it isn't enough to say, I love my friends, you must also love your enemies. Or he says it isn't enough to say, I do not kill, if indeed also you hate, you see. In Jesus' standard, hatred was in the same category as murder. And by saying that, he's giving what we call in philosophy the a fortiori argument that, this being the case, no one who claimed to keep the law was really keeping the law. See, the Pharisee comes along and he says, look, I keep the law. I don't kill anybody. I don't steal. I don't do this and I don't do that. And Jesus was re-evaluating that and saying to them, don't think you're keeping the law just because you don't commit the overt act. He said, if your heart is in it, or even though you don't commit the overt act, you're just as much guilty in God's sight. Now, why does he say things like that? Is he trying to set a higher standard? No, he's only trying to prove that they all need help. See, the Pharisee was saying, I don't need any help. I already keep the law. Jesus says, you're crazy. You're not keeping the law. Let me tell you what it really would mean to keep the law. This and this and this and this, and nobody does. It's just like the traffic laws out here. Very few people ever keep the traffic laws. Almost anybody you would ever ride with would break a dozen laws by the time they went from one place to another. The way they signal, the way they make their turns, just many different ways that they handle their car in little details that apparently, I mean, they're not serious enough to be stopped for, because if the police took the attitude that every little minor violation they'd stop them, they'd be spending all their time stopping people or on the streets. They've got to give their attention to other more major matters like curfew violations, things like that. Someday they may get around to looking at the criminals of our society, but in the meanwhile they have to keep active and for the drawing of their paychecks, so they run the vice squads and things like that. But anyway, the point here is, and it's a crucial point, really deep, and it's shunned by many in trying to interpret the scripture. They just throw up their hands and say, oh, well, we don't know, we just won't talk about it. This matter of divorce, remarriage, Jesus talks about that in connection with his problem with the law, wherein he says, no one keeps the law. I will prove it to you by saying that even if you tell me you don't murder, I say to you, if you hate somebody, you're as much guilty before God. Now, he's not suggesting you might as well kill them if you hate them. But he's only suggesting that you're no better than the guy that kills them if you hate. By the same token, a person that says, I keep the law, I've never been divorced, the Lord's attitude toward that would be, well, in so many different ways, as he goes on to say, even if a man looks on a woman to desire her, he's already committed adultery. He said there's so many ways in which the human being violates the laws of God, you might just as well admit defeat in the whole matter and throw yourself on the grace of God. And my attitude is generally that, especially in cases where couples married before they were Christians, or they married before they had any savvy about what was going on, that in a lot of these situations we're really dealing with a case where there wasn't really a marriage at all, but more living together. There are a lot of people, young people, that get married. They're not married. They're just licensing their relationship, you see. There's no marriage quality in it. There's no understanding of what marriage is all about. Now, I then have to look at an angle that Paul brings up in Titus, where he says that I want the younger women to marry. He's talking about that in context with the problem of young widows, where he says young widows, unless they're given a special gift of God to remain widows, which they could be. A young woman could have a special gift from God to remain a widow and not have a problem with it. But he said, generally speaking, the widows, the young widows, should marry. Because if they don't marry, they're going to wax wanton. What he even says is that if a young woman doesn't marry, she has a problem that may be too much for her physically. And so he encouraged marriage. Now, on using that same base, I say that to consign a young woman to a lifetime of singleness because of a mistake that she made in terms of marriage would not be in keeping with the grace of God, nor would it be wholesome. See, this is a tough thing, and the people get very legalistic about it, but for some strange reason, the problem of divorce seems to be the most awful sin in the book. And people that come into the church that have had a divorce problem are treated as second-rate citizens because they've had this problem. Yet other people go around acting like acting ugly all the time and gossiping and shafting people and lying and all the rest of it, and their regard is fine, upright, first-class citizens just because they didn't get a divorce. A lot of churches, well, they won't let a divorced person serve on boards and all this sort of thing. Well, I've had to deal with a lot of cases at the practical level, many cases. Here, for example, the young man that went in the years ago when he was in the service, while he was, and he was a Christian, the girl he married was a Christian. While he was overseas, she just blew her cork and just lived a promiscuous, careless life. She didn't want that kind of Christian life anymore. Well, she just shattered the whole marriage. When he got back home, there was nothing left of the marriage. I personally performed a wedding for him and a very fine Christian woman. They've been married many, many years and are strong and stable and steady, a great blessing in the Lord's service. I was right in that. I know I was right. I was following not the letter of the law, but the spirits. I would not condone just a case of a couple of Christian people who knew better and couldn't get along together and dissolved their marriage and looked around for somebody else. I wouldn't be a party to anything like that at all. But I look at the thing in terms of how God would look at it and how much God will forgive and eliminate past mistakes that might scar the life. It's better for a young woman to marry. Generally speaking, it is better. And Paul's discussion here has to do with a very difficult period of church history where there was persecution and distress, and he was trying to spare them this. But the general tenor of the scripture calls for the establishing of homes, families, children, so forth. And it is not sound for us to feel that just because a couple made a mistake in the early stages of their life, especially as non-Christians, but even sometimes as very, very weak, untrained Christians, where they've made mistakes, there ought to be redress of that error and the opportunity to build again a solid family unit for the glory of God. So I make no apologies for plowing into these divorce situations and sorting it out and making some positive decisions about it. And that so far my spirit has been completely free to make the choices I've made in performing some weddings that were involved in a divorce situation. Many, many pastors won't even talk about it. They won't, you know, all the first question, have you ever been divorced? Yes, boom, that's in. Hang the phone up, goodbye. I don't think that's sound. It may be safe, but it's not sound. So I've stuck my neck out a long way. And if you look very closely, you might find quite a few scars on his neck, because it has been out on the block quite a number of times, but never been totally apocopated. We're foolish enough to plow into it here. Well, we'll have to continue this next week, but don't pass any major judgments on me till we get through the whole chapter.